in a given civilization. Civilized life and technology offer many benefits to men. The simple, hardscrabble lives of our primitive ancestors may not have been as nasty, brutish, or short as Hobbes believed, but it would be foolish to say that men have gained nothing from agricultural innovation or the division of labor. Without such changes, there would have been no great works of art or literature, no great buildings or monuments, no printing press, no laptop for me to type on. Countless people have died throughout history from infections that anyone can cure today with cheap, over-the-counter medications. We enjoy abundant foods and strong imported wines, and perhaps most importantly, we have a steady supply of clean, drinkable water. Men wanted these things thousands of years ago, when the Epic of Gilgamesh story was conceived. Enkidu complained that he had grown weak and that he felt oppressed by the idleness of civilized life. Men have known since Gilgamesh that civilization comes at a cost. The manly virtues are raw and perishable. Males are, on average, naturally stronger, have a greater tendency to take risks, and they have a greater drive to master the world around them through techniques. But all of these aptitudes require cultivation. Muscles atrophy when improperly nourished and infrequently used. A man who never pushes his strength threshold will never even glimpse his physical potential, as anyone who has achieved substantial strength gains through physical training can attest. Strength is a use-it-or-lose-it aptitude. Men may be natural risk-takers, but the increased confidence and sure-footedness that we recognize as manly courage is the product of constant testing. The chest thumping of untested men is hardly courage. Hobbes called it vain glory because, quote, a well-grounded confidence begetteth attempt, whereas the supposing of power does not, end quote. Or, to put it in the words of Tyler Durden, how much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? Modern men are not merely lacking initiation into manhood, as some have suggested. They are lacking meaningful trials of strength and courage. Few modern men will truly know themselves as men in the way that their forefathers did. Likewise, skills must be mastered and practiced to be truly useful. Talent will only get you so far. If you are never truly challenged in a meaningful way and are only required to perform idiot-proofed corporate processes to get your meat and shelter, can you ever truly be engaged enough to call yourself alive, let alone a man? Later, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, after Gilgamesh killed the Bull of Heaven and overthrew the monstrous Humbaba, his comrade Enkidu died. Gilgamesh was distraught, and he searched for a way to cheat his own death. He met a young girl who made wine, and she told him that there was no way for him to avoid death. She told him to fill his belly with good things, to dance and be merry, to feast and rejoice. She told him to cherish his children and make his wife happy. Quote, for this too is the lot of man. End quote. This too is the lot of man. In times of peace and plenty, when their bellies are full and they feel safe, women have always advised men to abandon manly pursuits and the way of the gang, to enjoy the safe pleasures of vicariousness, and to join women in domestic life. When no threat is imminent, it has always been in the best interest of women to calm men down and enlist their help at home, raising children and fixing up the grass hut. This is the way of women. Men are people too. It is not my intention to characterize men as soulless monsters who care about nothing but blood and glory. Men do love, sometimes more passionately and more unconditionally than women. Men can be tender and nurturing. Any man who disputes that hates his father. Men write and tell stories and create things of remarkable beauty. All of these things can be part of being a man. Men and women share much in common, but this book is not about the things that make men human. It is about the things that make them men. Feminists dismiss biology and outdated ideas about masculinity and argue that men can change if they want to. Men do have free wills, and they can change to some extent. But men are not merely imperfect women. Men are individuals with their own interests, and they don't need women to show them how to be men. Women are not selfless spirit guides who have no interests or motivations of their own. Men have always had their own way, the way of the gang, and they've always inhabited a world apart from women. Can men change? Is the wrong question. Better questions are, why should men change? And what does the average guy get out of the deal? When pressed to answer this question, feminists and even men's rights activists never seem to be able to come up with anything but promises of increased financial and physical security and the freedom to show weakness and fear. Masses of men never rushed to the streets demanding freedom to show weakness and fear. And they never braved gunfire or battle axes for the right to cry in public. Countless men, however, have died for the ideas of freedom and self-determination, for the survival and honor of their own tribes, and for the right to form their own gangs. Feminists, elite bureaucrats, and wealthy men all have something to gain for themselves by pitching widespread male passivity. The way of the gang disrupts stable systems, threatens the business interests and social status of the wealthy, and creates danger and uncertainty for women. If men can't figure out what kind of future they want, there are plenty of people who are ready to determine what kind of future they'll get. They'll get a decorated cage. They'll get a fleshlight, a laptop, a gaming console, a cubicle, and a prescription drip. They'll get some exciting new gadgets. They'll get something that feels a little bit like being a man. Women will continue to mock them, and they'll deserve it. Lionel Tiger wrote that men, quote, don't get what they're about not to have, end quote. The world is changing, and men are being told that new is always better, that change is inevitable, that the future feminists and globalists want is unavoidable. Men are being told that their future is logical, that it is moral, that it is better, and that men had better learn to like it. But who is this new world really better for? Civilization comes at a cost of manliness. It comes at a cost of wildness, of risk, of strife. It comes at a cost of strength, of courage, of mastery. It comes at a cost of honor. Increased civilization exacts a toll of virility, forcing manliness into further redoubts of vicariousness and abstraction. Civilization requires men to abandon their tribal gangs and submit to the will of one big institutionalized gang. Globalist civilization requires the abandonment of the gang narrative, of us against them. It requires the abandonment of human-scale identity groups for one-world tribe. The same kind of men who once saw their own worth in the eyes of the peers who they depended on for survival will have to be satisfied with a social security number and the cheerfully manipulative assurances of their fellow drones. Feminist civilization requires the abandonment of patriarchy and brotherhood as men have known it since the beginning of time. The future being dreamed for us doesn't require the reimagining of masculinity. It ultimately demands the end of manhood and the soft embrace of personhood that has long been the feminist prescription for this ancient crisis of masculinity. This end of men, this decline of males, this new bonobo masturbation society of peace and plenty, this no man's land, is not inevitable. It will require the tacit or express consent of billions of men. Like every civilization, it must be built on the backs of men, and most of them must agree to abide by and enforce its laws. You can't have prisons without prison guards, and you can't have security without some kind of police. Men will have to get up in the morning and go to their clerking jobs and smile and consume and continue to amuse themselves according to regulation. Civilization requires a social contract, and men have to keep up their end of the bargain for it to work. This future can only happen if men help to create it. As I wrote in the opening chapter of this book, men must choose a way. To make this choice, they must ask themselves, what is best in life? The crisis of masculinity poses exactly that philosophical question. If you decide that true happiness for men lies in the elimination of risk, the satiation of hunger, the escape of labor, and the pursuit of fun, then our bonobo future may sound like some kind of one-world Las Vegas. I have come to the conclusion that the lot of man is to find a balance between the domestic world of comfort and the world of manly strife. Men cannot be men, much less good or heroic men, unless their actions have meaningful consequences to people they truly care about. Strength requires an opposing force. Courage requires risk. Mastery requires hard work. Honor requires accountability to other men. Without these things, we are little more than boys playing at being men. And there is no weekend retreat or mantra or half-assed rite of passage that can change that. A rite of passage must reflect a real change in status and responsibility for it to be anything more than theater. No reimagined manhood of convenience can hold its head high so long as the earth remains the tomb of our ancestors. Men must have some work to do that's worth doing, some sense of meaningful action. It is not enough to be busy. It is not enough to be fed and clothed and given shelter and safety in exchange for self-determination. Men are not ants or bees or hamsters. You can't just set up a plastic habitat and call it good enough. Men need to feel connected to a group of men. They need to have a sense of their place in it. They need to have a sense of identity that can't be bought at the mall. They need us, and to have us, you must also have them. We are not wired for one world tribe. I've been a non-believer all of my life, but I drop to my knees and sing the praises of any righteous God who collapsed this Tower of Babel and scattered men across the earth in a million virile competing cultures, tribes, and gangs. Honor, as I understand the definition, requires that kind of diversity. I don't say this because I think I'd personally fare better in a more primitive society. I spent the last 6 months reading and writing, not training for the zombie apocalypse. I hope that men, to quote Guy Garcia, quote, yank at their chains and pull the entire temple down with them, end quote. Because I hate to think that this is the end of the way of men. Everyone, from school teachers to the United Nations, is rushing to do away with outmoded models of masculinity. But they're not replacing it with anything better. In a review of Steven Pinker's book about violence, James Q. Wilson mentioned that the real change occurs when men care more about getting rich than getting bloody. It's tragic to think that heroic man's great destiny is to become economic man, that men will be reduced to craven creatures who crawl across the globe competing for money, who spend their nights dreaming up new ways to swindle each other. That's the path we're on now. What a withering, ignoble end. Humanity needs to go into a dark age for a few hundred years and think about what it's done. Start the world. Quote, I prefer not to use the words, let's stop something. I prefer to say, let's start something. Let's start the world. End quote. Peter Fonda, 2011. There is no democratic spur from our current path that can lead us back to the way of men. The men's rights movement seeks equity with women, and therefore points in the same direction as feminism. It wants to relieve men of making sacrifices on the behalf of women. It wants men and women alike to pursue individual prosperity without special gendered obligations or clearly defined sex roles. The anger that drives the men's movement comes from a sense that women aren't playing fairly, that they're cheating, that when given the chance, they will use the rhetoric of equality to skew things in their own favor. The men are right about that. Women are redesigning the world in their own image. It is naive for men to expect otherwise. The way of men is to fight the external threat and to fight other men. Sometimes men fight over women, but men have no history of fighting women. During times of peace and plenty, it has always been the way of women to lure a man away from the volatile gang, to seek his investment in her reproductive endeavor, and to encourage him to seek refuge and comfort in domesticity. A comfortable man is less likely to take risks, and warriors have always known that too much comfort makes men soft. Men are not going to rise up and form one great political action committee to fight the influence of women. Men of means see too much immediate social and financial gain in catering to the interests of women. Politicians see a more politically and socially active population that must be appeased, and they will continue to fall all over themselves to get the female vote. Women are better suited to and better served by the globalism and consumerism of modern democracies that promise security, no strings attached sex, and shopping. For the most part, male bureaucrats cannot be counted on to help men who they don't know, especially when there is political risk involved. Again, it is naive for men to expect otherwise. Another bulwark to social change on behalf of men is the reality of globalism. In America, we are conditioned to think of corporations as the man. But that's a very 20th century sense of things. Today's robber barons and fat cats are figureheads that captain global enterprises which can basically function without them. The reigning presidents and CEOs are often as disposable as the workers. They come and go. There is no man. There is only the profit-driven, hydra-headed legal entity, whose workers make cost-benefit analyses to increase profit and further their own status and salary, usually with an eye on producing immediate, short-term results. Those workers don't care about what happens to a company in 10 years because if they are savvy and career-minded, they may well be working for a competitor by then. There is no conspiracy here, only people looking out for their own immediate interests. If the legal department fears legal action, it will go through human resources and preempt it by initiating anti-sexist or anti-racist policies, or even soft affirmative action and public relations programs that reach out to litigious communities. It is in the interest of corporate enterprises in most cases to champion anti-sexist, pro-feminist, and anti-racist policies because identity conflicts can be costly and inefficient. To the global corporation, people are interchangeable units of labor priced at different values. Your sexual or tribal identity is a nuisance and a source of potential liability. Only thin identities are advantageous, like the kind of movies or music you prefer. Thin identities are marketing niches. Us versus them identities and different sex roles are problematic and cumbersome. But don't take my word for it. After all, I'm just a right-wing sexist. America's favorite left-wing anarchist, Noam Chomsky, wrote that, quote, "Capitalism basically wants people to be interchangeable cogs," end quote, and that differences among them are usually not functional. Chomsky was talking about race, but his comments that corporations see people only as consumers and producers, and that, quote, "any other properties they might have are kind of irrelevant and usually a nuisance," end quote, can logically be applied to differences between men and women. The genderless feminist utopia of humans who are neither masculine nor feminine is more efficient from the utilitarian perspective of the global enterprise. Don't expect the billions of dollars that international corporations wield to move in favor of men anytime soon. All of this is not to say that men's rights activists are wrong or useless, but that they can only perform triage and provide first aid. Men's rights activists can do things to make the situation better for men in the short term, like work for fairness in divorce proceedings and child custody cases and sexual harassment lawsuits. They can call attention to the lies and distortions of feminists, and they can work to discredit feminist experts on masculinity who repackage the same old 1970s boilerplate propaganda as science year after year. This is good work. Like what passes for conservatism today, it puts on a brake that slows the degeneracy that feminists call progress. Women individually are not to blame for everything that has transpired over the past few hundred years. Individual women can certainly not be blamed for the Industrial Revolution. They can't be blamed for the trains, planes, and automobiles that make globalism possible. They can't be blamed for Marxism, or the birth control pill, or the internet, or the shopping mall. Women as a group, can probably be blamed for abominations like reality television, and for a lot of bad music and art, and for making mainstream magazines almost unreadably gossipy and stupid. But individual women, a few figureheads aside, can't fairly be blamed for a whole lot. Women are just acting according to their natures and skewing things in their interests, as they've always wanted to, and as men have prevented them from doing for most of human history. It's not as though men have been selfless creatures, historically speaking. Men and women alike can be tremendously generous and self-sacrificing, but on an average day, we'll take care of our own interests first. That's the way of people. The point of this book is not to portray women as evil shrews. Women are humans who are slightly different than men, and given the opportunity, they will serve their own slightly different interests and follow their own slightly different way. Women aren't evil, but they aren't angels either. They are what they are. No matter how much sympathy some may have for the plight of modern men, women are not going to give up what they have so long as they believe it's worth having. They aren't going to rush to the polls to relieve themselves of advantages or support systems. As long as states offer women peace and plenty, women and big government will continue to enjoy a symbiotic relationship. Women can be sympathetic, but they're not dumb. Any return to the way of men will fail to receive bipartisan support. I also doubt that men will ever assert their interests as a sex through violent revolution. It's not realistic. There's no good pitch for it. Men aren't going to make the streets run red with their own blood for, well, what exactly would they even ask for? Men aren't going to rise up and storm the Capitol to demand the repeal of the 19th Amendment. It would be easier to get them to riot in Washington, D.C. to repeal the 16th Amendment and end federal income tax, something that women could get on board with too, and that isn't happening anytime soon. The closest thing that they've managed in recent years was the Tea Party movement, which, despite early media hysteria that it was a mob of angry white men, was quickly co-opted by women like Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann, who ended up turning it into something more like a tent revival potluck for heavily armed soccer moms. Even if men were inclined to organize against the state in its current form, men would lose before they even started. The state has the ability to seek out and identify anti-state movements who plan to use violence, and has crushed organized armed resistance movements on numerous occasions. Men aren't dumb either. Organized armed resistance movements end in death by cop long before they gain the money, the numbers, or the momentum necessary to make themselves a viable threat. This isn't Africa or Central America. But what if it were? What if the United States were just a little bit more like Mexico? I worked with an illegal immigrant for a while, and he told me that while he loved his homeland and his culture, he didn't want to raise his family in a place without law and order. He told me stories about police shaking down drivers for cash instead of writing tickets. When I visited a border town a few years ago, it was striking how blurry the line was between the federales and a gang. There was no officer-friendly. The federales were a bunch of guys with assault rifles whose purpose was clearly to observe and intimidate. When they got a call, they jumped on the back of what looked like a Ford F-150 with an aftermarket roll bar and made off in a cloud of desert dust. In other places, the federales don't look so tough. It's not unusual for Mexican police to wear ski masks at work for fear of gang retribution. That retribution can be brutal, as it was recently in the border town of Guadalupe, where a female police chief went missing around Christmas in 2010. Quote, Erica Gandara was a former radio dispatcher for the police department in the town of 9000, which is just across the U.S. border, 1 mile from Fabens, Texas. The previous police chief was murdered and decapitated. His head was found on an ice chest. Gandara, 28, a single woman with no children, was the only applicant for the job and its salary of $580 a month. One policeman was murdered during Gandara's first week on the job. By the time she became chief, the entire force of 8 patrolmen had either been killed or fled. She was the sole law enforcement representative in the Juarez Valley town that was part of the war between competing drug cartels for access routes into the U.S., end quote. In September 2011, Reuters reported that violence was slowing down in Tijuana after years of bloodshed, in part because the gangs there had finally settled a turf war and one gang established near-complete control over the area. If men are going to reassert their interests and return to the way of men, they're not going to do it through a democratic movement or a social movement or an armed political uprising. They're going to do it in a way that looks a lot more like what La Familia was doing with John Eldridge's work. They're going to do it through gangs in areas of the world where the state has lost power and credibility. They're going to take some of the ideas from surviving male traditions and repurpose them to create their own unique identities, their own us. The current level of security we enjoy, or fear, depending on what side of the law you're on, is very, very expensive. And the United States is a very large territory. The quality of policing we have today is the direct result of our wealth and status as a major world power. Our police are on a payroll, and less money will mean fewer police, more frustrated police, and more police corruption. As the power of the state wanes, non-state actors gain breathing room and influence. The United States is far bigger than North Korea, and the United States is not China. Mao had to kill over 40 million people to get the Chinese on the same page. Not including those who died in various famines, it seems to have taken Stalin at least 3 million deaths to keep the Soviets in order. His tyranny gave birth to the Voi di Zakonia, or thieves-in-law, who represent only a small portion of the crime syndicates currently active in modern Russia. Criminal gangs are active all over the United States, especially in border zones and ghettos where policing is inadequate or viewed as illegitimate and tyrannical, as it is by many blacks who see the police as inherently racist, and in areas with high concentrations of illegal immigrants who see themselves as unfairly persecuted. For many, the state is already the other. In the film Gran Torino, Clint Eastwood's character, Walt Kowalski, confessed to Father Janovich that one of his sins was failing to pay taxes on a private sale he had made several years prior. He said, "It's the same as stealing. That's the country my grandfather lived in." Many people who grew up before the Vietnam era felt that connected to their nation. They were invested in it. The United States was us. Or, truer to the spirit of it, it was we the people. In the post-Vietnam era, it seems as though more and more people on the left and the right alike regard the government as them. Whether they consider themselves Democrats, Republicans, or independents of some kind, whether they make $20,000 a year or $200,000 a year, most people today will pore over their tax returns looking for any way they can find to pay less. Few would give a second thought to claiming profits on a sale they've made using a Craigslist ad. If you told them it was their civic duty, they'd probably give you a look they save for Jehovah's Witnesses. Small business owners usually find ways to cut corners, and many are happy to hide income or hire workers illegally or under the table, to to avoid paying taxes or dealing with complicated regulations. Every year, average Americans download billions of dollars worth of pirated music and movies. Like smoking marijuana, the same pot that Mexican gangs are trafficking, these things have become socially acceptable practices at almost every level of society. The Italians have a saying for this. Tutti capovole, nessuno capovole. It means, if everyone is guilty, no one is guilty. Walt Kowalski's America is long gone. Globalism and nationalism have irreconcilable ends. Globalism is undermining our sense of national identity, our connection to the government. The American economy was placed in the hands of globalists. All recent administrations have promoted and said starry-eyed things about the magic of the global economy. And now the economy is like a plate being balanced on a stick by a circus clown. There's a lot of funny money out there spinning around, and any number of factors could send us further into financial decline. We're dependent on cheap imported technology, cheap imported food, cheap imported fuel. A dramatic spike in gas prices or a major national disaster could easily turn a volatile place like Southern California into a war zone. States are selling their own toll highways to foreign nations for short-term cash infusions. There's already a sense among people under 40 that the money they pay into Social Security won't be there, or won't be worth anything, by the time they get old. People who work know they are throwing money into a black hole. Others are working the system and taking whatever they can get. Without endless economic growth, the United States won't be able to make good on its promises of endless prosperity and security. As things get worse, and the state seems powerless to help, the state will seem less and less legitimate. People will lose their moral connection to it. Laws will seem more like revenue traps and shakedowns. The state will start to seem more like another extortion racket, and, as in Mexico, people will have a harder time telling the good guys from the bad guys. The U.S. of us will become the U.S. of them, and will balkanize from within. If not officially, then unofficially. It's already happening. The new way of women depends on prosperity, security, and globalism. Any return of honor and the way of men and the eventual restoration of balance and harmony between the sexes will require the weakening of all three. One of my favorite books is Anthony Burgess's The Wanting Seed. It's a sci-fi novel that tells the story of a future when, due to overpopulation, the state encourages homosexuality and effeminacy and officially discourages reproductive families. Throughout the book, Burgess writes about a theory of cyclical history that moves through three phases: Pell phase, interphase, and Gus phase. In the Gus phase, named after St. Augustine, humanity is viewed through the eyes of a stern father who expects men to be violent and untrustworthy. Men see only what Peterson and Wrangham would have called the demonic in each other, and those who seek order rule with an iron fist. After a period of security, people demonstrate that they can behave reasonably well, and men start to think that people are not so bad after all. Thinking shifts into the Pell phase mode, named for St. Pelagius, wherein men see each other as intrinsically good, peaceful, and perfectible through the gentle guiding touch of social reform. However, this rose-colored, noble savage view of man does not reflect his nature either. Man can't always be trusted to follow the rules. He plays the system and does what he wants, and that leads to distrust, disorder, and disillusionment. This is when As Burgess put it, quote, "Disappointment opens up a vista of chaos," end quote. During the middle phase of the cycle, called the interphase, there is violence and chaos and tyranny. It's a great shake-up that brings about another Gus phase, and eventually a new Pell phase, and the cycle continues. Men will not reassert themselves in any meaningful way through additional tweaking of an optimistic Pelagian system that is based on a pleasant denial of human nature. Men will reassert their interests during the interphase, when states weaken and become hollow, as futurist John Robb believes they will. Men will assert their interests through a return to their most basic social form. When the aching womb of the state can no longer provide the services or the security that keep men passive and dependent, localized groups of men who trust each other will build smaller networks to protect and further their own interests. In the presence of weak tyranny and the absence of strong nationalism, the shepherds will gather round their Robin Hoods and they will found new tribes. In the chaos that follows disappointment, gangs of men can restart the world. Their future, the one world nanny state from cradle to grave, the global civilization of managers and clerks, the thin consumer identities, the bonobo masturbation society, is already showing signs of stress. Their future is based on unsustainable illusions and lies about human nature. Their future requires too many men to deny their own immediate interests to serve an abstract greater good that is far beyond human scale. All over the world, the Star Trek future that was once considered inevitable is starting to look improbable. The European Union is struggling. The global economy is faltering. And every day, more people are starting to acknowledge that America is in a decline from which it will not recover. Their future is already failing. It just needs a push. If you want to push things toward the way of men and start the interphase, create disappointment. Throughout 2011, Occupy Wall Street protesters camped out in public parks across the country. They were angry about something. They weren't sure what. Their messages were incoherent. They were desperate. They wanted the government to come to their rescue. They wanted the government to fix things. They wanted the government to stop corporate greed, as if it is possible to demand that global corporations stop acting to maximize profit. The occupants still just barely believed the dream that the state is beholden to the will of the people. They still wanted to believe that the state cares what they want. They wanted to believe that the state wants them to be happy. They were emotionally attached to the idea that the government cares. But they already suspected that it doesn't. It doesn't because it can't. Like global corporations, states have escaped human scale. There is no man to fight. States are institutions whose ultimate goals are survival, perpetuation, and expansion. When the protesters went home, they achieved nothing. Nothing changed, though a few talking heads offered reassurances that the protesters had been heard. People need to stop looking to the state for help and direction. They must become disillusioned and disappointed. To push things in a direction that is ultimately, though not immediately, better for men, the emotional connection between the people and the state must be severed completely. When the body of the people is released from the head of the sovereign, chaos will ensue. In that chaos, men will find themselves. They will stop looking to the state for help and start looking to each other. Together, men can create smaller, tighter, more localized systems. People say they want a world that's more rational. But a world that's out of step with human nature isn't more rational at all. Men aren't getting more rational. They're getting weaker. They're getting more fearful. They're giving up more and more control. There is no high road. The only way out for men is the way of the gang. How to start a gang. Quote, only where the state ends, there begins the human being who is not superfluous. There begins the song of necessity, the unique and inimitable tune. End quote. Friedrich Nietzsche, Thus Spake Zarathustra. Any return to the way of men is probably going to happen in hollow states through extra-legal means. Gangs form out of necessity, or to exploit opportunities. Gangs are going to gain the most traction in areas where state influence is weak, creating both necessity and opportunity. Furthermore, gangs are proto-states. Proto-states threaten the power of larger, existing states, so when men form proto-states to assert their own interests, their actions will be outlawed by those states. It is not my intent here to tell you how to start a criminal enterprise. I have romanticized gangs somewhat to make a point about the nature of men. But I am not suffering from any delusion. Modern gangs are run by good guys who take from the rich and give to the poor. I have every reason to believe that life in a gang existing inside a collapsed state would be nasty, brutish, and short. There is no shortage of evidence about gang brutality, infighting, human trafficking, raping, or murder, almost for the sake of murder alone. Wrangham and Peterson called the gang impulse male demonism for some good reasons. The conclusion I reached while writing this book was that the gang is the kernel of masculine identity. I believe it is also the kernel of ethnic, tribal, and national identity. As author Bell Hooks wrote in a rather different context, quote, the essence of patriarchal masculinity, end quote. If you want to follow the way of men, if you want to advance a return to honor and manly virtue, if you want to steel yourself against an uncertain future, start a gang. Honor requires an honor group, a group of men with similar values. Honor requires the possibility of dishonor in the eyes of peers whose respect you value. The cultivation of manly virtue is accelerated by competition and the expectations of male peers. And if you want to become resilient to uncertainty and chaos, you need a circle of men who you trust and who you can depend on. Some readers will inevitably respond, my girlfriend is awesome. She takes boxing, shoots guns, and fixes cars. She's my partner. Well, that's nice. But if your strategy for the future is holing up with Ma and the Chillins, your strategy sucks. I don't care if your girlfriend is a certified ninja. She's not worth eight men. Kill Bill was not a documentary. A strong and skillful woman will be worth more to you in a crisis than a prima donna, but she can't replace the men in your life. No woman can take the place of men in a man's life. It is evolutionarily sound for women to want to secure your commitment to them and attempt to place themselves at the center of your world. They'll want to be involved in everything you do, and they'll be on guard against perceived threats to their security and your commitment. Men have been negotiating the crisis of masculinity, the push and pull between civilized domesticity and the lure of gang life, for centuries. Men need to set boundaries and make time for men in their lives. It's important to their sense of identity. It's important to their sense of security and belonging. And it's a good survival strategy. Part of the reason we are where we are right now is that men stopped depending on each other and started depending on the state. The family unit is not enough. A support network of 10 is better than a support network of 2. To get a sense of how one might go about expanding that support network and start a gang, here's a working definition of what a gang really is, based on the idea of men bonding, creating a group identity, and setting up a perimeter. Gang, a bonded, hierarchical coalition of males, allied to assert their interests against external forces. A gang is essentially a male group identity. It's an us. It's a go-to group of men allied against them. In an emergency situation, the us is often defined by proximity. You've seen the movie. A bunch of unlikely characters get stuck together by unforeseen circumstances and are forced to work out their differences and learn to depend on each other. That could certainly happen. But depending on the luck of the draw, isn't a great strategy. Picking your team is a better strategy. Create proximity. The internet is a good filter. It's a good way to find men who share some of your values. However, your friends on message boards and on social networking sites scattered all over the world are not going to be there for you when the proverbial shit hits the proverbial fan. Spend more time making contact with men who are geographically closer to you. If you have close friends in your area, consider moving into the same apartment complex or within a few blocks of one another. Think about the way gangs start in inner cities. Men and boys have lived and died to defend tribes with territories as small as a few blocks. Proximity creates familiarity and shared identity. It creates us. Spreading our alliances across nations and continents keeps us reliant on the power of the state and the global economy. Men who are separated and have no one else to rely on must rely on the state. Choose your us. A lot of factors could define the boundaries of us against them. If your religion is important to you, that's a good place to start. Mormon men, for instance, would probably fall into a community gang fairly easily. If your ethnic heritage or race is something you feel strongly about, as is very often the case with gangs, then that might be your starting point. Familiarity and likeness make trust easier to establish. However, sports teams make out well enough with men from very different backgrounds. If a desirable, superordinate goal, like survival, is introduced, it has been proven that men can put aside all sorts of differences. Men with opposing viewpoints can respect each other and enjoy civilized debates. But when it comes to forming us, it's better to have a group of men who are on the same page about the issues most important to them. If you have decided, after reading this book, that you want to return to the way of men, The men in your gang will have to be committed to undermining the globalist masturbation society, hollowing out the state, and reviving a culture of honor. Create fraternity. A gang is a fraternity, a bonded brotherhood of men. That said, don't start trying to figure out your colors or your secret handshake just yet. These kinds of male cultural phenomena will occur organically as the result of shared history and identity. Only huge organizations like the army can effectively sort a bunch of men into a group and artificially create a gang or brotherhood. It is possible for political movements to do this, but if they appear to be openly anti-government, their high profile is going to attract the attention of the authorities. You don't need a formal group or a membership charter, and you don't need to elect a president. What you need is FaceTime. You can bond with men online, but only to a point. People can hide online in ways that they can't in person. Men are tactical thinkers. They guard themselves. To get to know a man, you need to spend time with him. You need to do things together. You need to build trust. Don't expect a casual acquaintance to have your back when you're in trouble. A solid friendship is just like any other relationship. It requires give and take. It requires some time and some history. If you know some guys you can connect with and who are on more or less the same page philosophically, make sure you make time for them. Set aside time to create that history and to build that trust. Even women who are like one of the guys will have a chilling effect on that process. Men are not honest with each other in the same way when women are present, and establishing trust requires honesty. Men are going to want to have girlfriends and wives and families and other connections with women in their lives, and that is all well and good. But as I said, you can't expect men who really don't know you to help you through tough times. Put in the effort. Eating and drinking together is fine, but it makes more sense to plan tactically oriented outings. You need to learn how to read each other and how to work together as a group. Go to the shooting range. Go hunting. Play paintball. Go to the gym. Take martial arts classes. Join a sports team. Take a workshop. Learn a useful skill. Fix something. Build something. Make something. Get off your asses and do something. In harder times, the men that you do these kinds of things with are going to be the first men you call. They will be your gang. They will be your us. I'm going to close this book with some Viking wisdom concerning male friendship from the sayings of Har, also known as the Havamal. If friend thou hast, whom faithful thou deemest, and wishest to win him for thee, open thy heart to him, nor withhold thy gifts, and fare to find him often. If faithful friend thou hast found for thee, then fare thou find him full oft. Overgrown is soon with tall grass and bush the trail which is trod by no one. This has been The Way of Men, written by Jack Donovan, narrated by Jack Donovan. Print copyright 2012 by Jack Donovan. Production copyright 2015 by Jack Donovan.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.